Since its publication 6 years ago, the papal encyclical Amoris Laetitia has been a source of controversy. The most disputed chapter is the infamous chapter 8, which talks of accompanying, discerning, and integrating weakness. Is this chapter consistent with Catholic teaching, or does it stray from orthodoxy? That's the topic we're going to talk about today on Crisis Point. Hello, I'm Eric Sammons, your host and editor-in-chief of Crisis Magazine. Just want to encourage people to like and subscribe to this episode, to this channel. Let other people know about it however you can. Our guest today is Dr. Eduardo Echevarria, and he's a professor of philosophy and systematic theology at Sacred Heart Major Seminary in Detroit. It's a great seminary, by the way. I've heard many good things about it. Lots of great people there. He earned his doctorate in philosophy from the Free University in Amsterdam and his STL from the University of St. Thomas Aquinas the Angelicum in Rome. And he is the author of, I got it right here, Pope Francis, the Legacy of Vatican II. Welcome to the program.
Thank you, Eric. Always a pleasure.
Yeah, it's great having you here. And it's great to talk about this. So I am just going to, I know we're going to get into details here, but I'm just going to jump, put you on the spot right at the beginning. Okay. Is Amoris Laetitia Orthodox?
I would say no.
See, that's well, all I wanted was right there. Now, of course, we got an hour to talk about why your answer is no.
About chapter 8.
Right.
So is the more I would say is the moral reasoning the framework in which Francis sort of sets out his the structure of moral reasoning. I would say no, despite what he says. He repeatedly says, well, remember, he gives us three criteria. He says you have to read the whole encyclical. I agree. I think, for instance, the Pope, and I argue that in my book, in chapter 4, his view of marriage is orthodox. His view of marriage is orthodox. There's nothing. I don't think any fair reading of him on that matter can criticize him. I mean, I try to show how he's consistent with Benedict and also with John Paul II. But so my issue is not over his view of marriage and not even for that matter, his view of humani vitae, because in the eighth chapter, he in fact affirms the core doctrine of humani vitae. And that is that each and every single conjugal act has to be open to life, that it's not the marriage as a whole that has to be open to life, but each and every single act has to be open to life. But having said that, when we get into the question of how do we deal pastorally, his understanding of pastoral reasoning and his understanding of moral reasoning that informs his view of how to be pastoral to people, that's where, in my view, it's not orthodox, despite what, that the book of Peter Pedro Gabriel, The Orthodoxy of Amoris Laetitia, it's entirely concerned with the eighth chapter, because of all the chapters in that book, I used to say to people, if there was no eighth chapter, nobody would care really about Amoris Laetitia.
Right.
Because there are some nice things. There are some, his discussion about marriage and his discussions about 1 Corinthians 13 and all. There's all good stuff there that one can learn. Without the eighth chapter, it wouldn't be anything to worry about, to be honest. It's the eighth chapter.
And I think the eighth, one of the things that struck me, I reread the eighth chapter to get ready for this. And one thing that struck me, I don't know if I noticed it the first time, was just even the title of the chapters, Accompanying, Discerning, Integrating Weakness. I thought that was interesting because he used the term weakness. Now, of course, I'm not quite sure what the original word he used, but the English term he's using is weakness. And of course, in moral theology, there's a big, big difference between weakness and sin.
Right.
They're not the same thing.
I always say that Dante, in the third volume of the Divine Comedy, he does not put weak people in hell. He puts unrepentant people in hell.
Right. Right. I mean, and that's a great point because, I mean, first of all, we're all weak. That's the fall. I mean, we're all weak.
That's right.
And so I wonder, what do you say about that? Like, just the whole idea of what is, because it sounds like the way it's setting it up is that if you're not following the church's, what he calls ideal for marriage, it sounds like it's just a weakness. And I think that I'm not saying he's saying it explicitly, but it does seem that he's suggesting that that's simply a weakness. And of course, a weakness, we can all go to communion for a weakness. No, right. Nobody's going to be denied communion because they're weak.
Right. That's so there you have the distinction that Gabriel emphasizes between a mortal and a venial sin.
Right.
And so, but if you don't mind, if we could first start by my saying something about that, about not just weakness, but about why the chapter 8, I think, sort of creates a gap between mercy and truth.
Sure, sure.
Mercy and truth. And part of that, I think, has to do with the fact that the Pope tends to emphasize what he sees as the good elements in, I don't like the term irregular relationships. I would prefer to use the phrase spiritually and morally problematic relationships. I mean, it's more of a mouthful, but it's more accurate, it seems to me, that you're talking about problematic relationships, not just irregular ones. So in several places, for instance, in paragraph 292, he's making a distinction between different forms of unions. There's obviously a question there whether you can actually speak of a homosexual union.
Right.
Okay. But in any case, putting that to some forms of union, he said, radically contradict this ideal, so the ideal of marriage, while others realize it in at least a partial and analogous way. And he says that several times, at the beginning in the first chapter, and then even again in paragraph 297 and in paragraph 78. So you here's the distinction that I draw. We used to, when we think about non-Christian religions, and we say that the church says that there are seeds of the word there, that you can find elements of truth and goodness there. Now, what the church never says is that those religions in and of themselves are salvific.
Right.
So it's one thing to say that you can find elements of goodness and truth there. It's another thing to say that those religions somehow approximate, anticipate, you know, the Christian faith and hence are salvific. Well, if you go back and you look not only, you know, these the synod and what they said, They confused, it seems to me. It's one thing to say that even cohabiting, that you can find elements, good things in cohabiting relationships. Maybe they have children and they're trying to take care of their children and they're being, in whatever way is good to take care of a kid. It's one thing to say that those relationships have elements of goodness in them. It's another thing to say that the relationship as a relationship is good and is simply, as the Pope says, a realization in a partial and analogous way of marriage.
Right.
And so what happens there, you see, is that he thinks, in my view, wrongly, but he thinks that you need to approach the relationship by looking at what's good in those relationships and seeing those relationships as somehow an anticipation of the marital state is, you see.
Right.
And so because of that, he says at one point also, in pastoral discernment, there's a need to identify elements that can foster evangelization and human and spiritual growth. So he's not going to speak of these relationships as relationships being sinful, being disordered in some way. He'll begin by looking at at what's good in them, seeing them as somehow a partial or analogous realization of the moral law. And then what happens is, it seems to me, he doesn't want, it's all about mercy then, and it's never about, he rejects the idea of, in fact, he explicitly says it, that attaching certain conditions to the reception of mercy, he says. Because this is at the end of the chapter, where he does say that, we have to show concern for the integrity of the church's moral teaching. But he says, special care should always be shown to emphasize and encourage the highest and most central values of the gospel, particularly the primacy of charity, as a response to the completely gratuitous offer of God's love. At times, he says, we find it hard to make room for God's unconditional love in our pastoral activity. We put so many conditions on mercy, this is in paragraph 311, we put so many conditions on mercy that we empty it of its concrete meaning and real significance. That is the worst way of watering down the gospel. And then he knows that he's getting himself in hot water, because then he says, it is true, for example, that mercy does not exclude justice and truth. But first and foremost, we have to say that mercy is the fullness of justice and the most radical manifestation of God's truth. This is kind of like wordplay, because he doesn't want to attach any conditions there to the administration of mercy. So when people come to church and they're cohabiting, even homosexuals, never mind just heterosexuals, if you follow his strategy, you're going to look for elements of goodness in that relationship, and you're going to offer people mercy, but you're not going to offer them, because you find those elements of goodness, you're not going to attach any kinds of conditions, like you have to change your life.
Right.
You can't be living together, et cetera, right. Et cetera.
Yeah, and I think this idea, what you're saying about mercy and truth, what I saw when I look at this, it's almost like it's not truth. It's what he calls an ideal. But an ideal isn't what the church, it's not like married life, a man and a woman living monogamously, permanently.
No, that's why the relationship as a qua relationship, the relationship as a relationship is a sinful one. Right. Even if there are positive elements in that relationship, you can't switch over and say, and think of the relationship as somehow being good in itself. No more than you can think that if you find elements of like Nostra Aetate, from Vatican II, that says the church rejects nothing that is true and good in these religions. But it doesn't turn it over and then say, and those religions are in and of themselves salvific, you see, right. That they're somehow saving. And too many, so it seems to me, rather than, I talk about that in the chapter, John Paul II had emphasized the interdependency of mercy and truth. Truth in that sense is merciful, because the truth shall make you free. So when someone comes, you're a pastor, someone comes to your parish, they're cohabiting, whether they're heterosexuals, homosexuals, whatever, you have to lay out the conditions. And those are not my conditions.
Right.
Those are the conditions of the Lord. So right. You have to lay out the conditions. Remember in the letter of John, in the first chapter, in the ninth verse, if you confess your sins, he is faithful and just to forgive you your sins and to cleanse you from all unrighteousness. So if you're serious about that, you have to change your life. You can't be cohabiting. It seems to me that, and he can't. He'll say at one point, if you have somebody who, where does he say that? He'll say at one point, if someone rejects the teachings of the church and so on, that person, which is amusing because. In paragraph 297, he says, naturally, if someone flaunts an objective sin as if it were part of the Christian ideal or wants to impose something other than what the church teaches, he or she can in no way presume to teach or preach to others. This is a case of something which separates from the community. But then he says, yet even for that person, there can be some way of taking part in the life of community, whether in social service, prayer meetings, or another way that his or her own initiative, together with the discernment the parish priest may suggest.
Yeah, I feel like, though, that he's not that we're not really recognizing here the destructive power of sin.
No.
So if, for example, a married couple, let's say they're contracepting.
Right.
Let's say lots of things about the relationship are good.
Right.
Maybe they're very patient with each other. They're very caring. They care for their kids that they have. Well, but they're contracepting. That in and of itself, that sinful action that is inserted into the relationship, that itself is destructive to the relationship. And that's one of the reasons why they need you need to go to confession and then receive communion to have the grace to heal and repair that destructiveness. And obviously, if that's true of a contracepting couple, it's true of a couple that's not really even in a state of marriage or just in a union.
Well, and as you say rightly, he rarely talks about at that point in this context. He rarely talks about sin.
Right.
We'll be back after a quick break.
Playlist shuffled? Check. Drinks on ice? Check. ZBiotics? Make the most of your time with friends by starting your evening with ZBiotics, the only pre-alcohol probiotic designed to make those rough mornings after drinking alcohol a thing of the past. ZBiotics is key for those who live for the moment. Visit ZBiotics.com to learn more.
Yeah, and I think that was clear from just the whole thing. He calls it weakness, and he wants to emphasize the good. And that's, I mean, I thought this, I wrote that a lot in my book, Defensive Deadly Indifference, the idea of, it's not that we're saying there isn't truth in other religions or in relationships, unions that are not marital. But like you said, that doesn't make them
salvific in and of themselves.
Right, exactly. A marriage that's not, I'm sorry, a union that is not, let's say a homosexual union or a union between two people who are not married, that is not, in a sense, I mean, the word, I'm stretching the word a little bit, salvific, because it is marriage that my marriage is going to be part of my salvation or against my salvation.
Right.
And so this union, this false union actually then directs somebody away from Christ. Away from salvation. And so that's never even mentioned, though. It's all about, well, there's good things in there. And it's this like understanding that having those good things will somehow lead to
not even that. That's true. That's also part of the suggestion. But the fact is, there's also this idea that relationship, which is spiritually and morally problematic, is at least, he says, a partial an analogous way, a realization of marriage. That seems to me to be that's wrongheaded, that approach, because of course, then again, if you're emphasizing the good, you're not going to attach any conditions for receiving grace, forgiveness, penance, and so on. But this, go ahead.
I was going to say one of the things, just to bring that up. Like, I feel like though. This chapter really puts a lot of pressure, undue pressure on pastors, because over and over again, he says, your pastor will can talk with you and they can make the determination. Well, we also know outside of this that Pope Francis himself has said he's never denied communion to anybody.
Right.
And so and in the context of a pro-abortion politician, so in the context of somebody who's a public sinner. And so when he's saying, it's up to the pastors to decide what to do. But he's also saying at the same time, but by the way, here's what I always do. I feel like what happens is that the pastor is put in this awful situation in which a couple comes to him in some type of wrong union, like you said, morally problematic union. But they want to receive communion or whatever. Well, what's that pastor supposed to do? Because he's been backed into a corner where his only option is to go ahead and let him have communion, because it doesn't seem like he's got any way to say, well, no, the problem is the union itself.
That's
and
right.
They would just say, well, the Pope said everybody can receive communion.
Well, exactly. So the Pope has, as one priest friend of mine from New Jersey once said, when the Pope began washing the feet of everybody, he said, the Pope just threw me under the bus.
Right.
Because For years, I was arguing that only men, males, can have their feet washed. And now the Pope is not only washing the feet of men and women, he's washing the feet of Muslims and Hindus and blah, blah, blah. So a lot of priests feel thrown under the bus because unsupported by the Pope. But Let's go on here, if you don't mind.
Sure.
Okay. So another thing that, of course, is true, and that Gabriel talks about it, that's kind of like at the core of his thesis and of his book, and that is the distinction between objective and subjective morality.
Right.
Okay. So obviously, there is objective morality. There are some things that are right and wrong. Subjective morality has to do with the question of responsibility. Invincible ignorance and mitigating circumstances. That's for him, like the whole thing.
That's a big part of his argument. Exactly.
That's it. So you're under mitigating circumstances. And if you're under mitigating circumstances, your culpability is diminished such that, you can even receive communion because mitigating circumstances, if you're not fully responsible, you may know what's right and wrong, but the circumstances are such that they mitigate your responsibility in doing the wrong thing. And so you haven't fully consented and all of these things. So, of course, and of course, this is big for him because he says this is why Amoris Laetitia, chapter 8, is not inconsistent with Veritatis Splendor, because John Paul II also makes the distinction between objective morality and also questions regarding responsibility and ignorance, invincible ignorance, and all that. So all of that is fine. Also,
just to interrupt for 1 second, just to be clear for our audience, an example of mitigating circumstance might be somebody who is maybe has an addiction, some type of psychological or like some physiological addiction. And so therefore they might know an action is wrong.
Right.
But because of their addiction, there's certain mitigating circumstances to whether or not that the gravity of that sin. And so,
the sin can be grave, but whether or not you're responsible for
right.
having
yeah, better way to put it. Yes, exactly. That's right.
So
yes.
We can quote what, Francis quotes from the catechism, imputability, whether we impute guilt to a person for having done the wrong thing. The fact that we don't impute guilt to you doesn't mean that you didn't do the wrong thing. It just means that you're not responsible for having done the wrong thing. So imputability and responsibility for an action can be diminished or even nullified by ignorance, inadvertence, duress, fear, habit, inordinate attachments, and other psychological or social factors. So to form an equitable judgment about the subject's moral responsibility and to guide pastoral action, one must take into account the effective immaturity, force of acquired habit, conditions of anxiety, or other psychological or social factors that lessen or even extenuate moral culpability.
Right.
So Gabriel, that's his whole argument really hinges on that distinction between objective and subjective morality. And then under subjective morality, you have these mitigating circumstances, such as the catechism describes there, which mitigate, lessen your responsibility for even if what you're doing is wrong. Your guilt. Maybe we don't impute guilt because of certain circumstances that have lessened your responsibility. Now, let's assume that that's hunky-dory. Let's assume that you can argue for that. John Paul argues for that. In Veritatis Splendor, he of course doesn't say that that mitigating circumstances, which have to do with responsibility and all that, doesn't take away from the wrongness of the act, or what you did, and what you did can be wrong.
Right.
And yet we can say, we're not going to impute guilt to you because there are all these circumstances that lessened your knowledge, et cetera, et cetera. Now, what I want to do is then just focus on the specific issue where he ignores this, it seems to me, Gabriel, where the Pope says that someone rejects the moral rules. He knows what the moral rules are. He knows what the moral standard is, but He does not accept it. I hear the Pope's, he's actually a subject may know full well the rule, yet have great difficulty in understanding its inherent value. Now, it seems to me, you can't assume that this person who doesn't accept the moral rule is somehow not responsible for having rejected it. I think the Pope, I say at one point in my book, in that in my chapter on Amoris, there's a certain optimism in Francis's readiness to hold individuals blameless,
right,
without considering the reasons why they are unwilling to address the difficulty. If you're a priest, you're a pastor, you're having pastoral discussion with this couple, and they say to you, "We don't agree with the church's teaching that we should be married before we live together, before we have sex. We don't agree with it. We find it difficult to understand why the church says that." Is that a mitigating circumstance?
Right.
I don't think so.
Right.
Gabriel spends a lot of time talking about invincible ignorance and ignorance for which you're not responsible, but he rarely talks about vincible ignorance. That is to say, an ignorance for which you are culpable. Did you do the best that you could in trying to get at this, in trying to understand? I say it, I actually quote Karl Rahner at one point on this. Karl Rahner says, "Conscience can easily make mistakes," Rahner says, "and it is very difficult to distinguish its voice, the real voice of conscience, from the voice of precipitation, passion, convenience, or self-will, or of moral primitiveness, which cannot see the finer distinctions or the more remote consequences of the act." I say Francis overlooks all that, Gabriel overlooks all that, and hence softens the responsibility an individual has to conform his conscience to the objective moral law, here and now. So I don't think just one last thing. I say at one point, and then I'm discussing this other, the guy, Coco Palmieri, who used to be the prefect of dealing with legislative texts. He was just as confused, in my view, as Francis. There's also no mention made of the reasoning that led them to hold these false beliefs. For example, negligent reasoning.
Right.
You're sitting there in your office, you're a pastor. These people come in and they tell you we're contracepting, we're living together, et cetera, et cetera. What constitutes the mitigating circumstances? Have you asked them? Well, why do you believe that? Why doesn't their position, which is a false belief, why doesn't it reflect negligent reasoning, or ideological rationalization, or wishful thinking?
Yeah, the whole context, remember, of chapter 8 is that these people are meeting with their pastor. So the idea of invincible ignorance really struggles to grasp that, because if they're meeting with their pastor who's telling them what the objective moral law is, and I think the mitigating circumstances. So to be clear, you know, Catholic morality always says like the three parts of a moral act.
Right.
Or it's the act itself, whether or not
right.
it's a grave matter.
That's right.
You have
that's
the
right.
circumstances, and then also have your
intention.
Whether or not how much you're accepting the action. You know, your
what the act is oriented to. In a sense, the purpose of the act.
Right, your will and choosing it.
Right, right. But we don't decide right. the rightness of the act. We decide the rightness of the act in terms of the act itself.
Right. So it is possible. So in order for it to be a mortal sin, the act itself does need to be grave. So if I take
right.
some, post-it notes from my office, that is a sin. I shouldn't do it, but it's not going to rise to the level of a mortal sin.
No,
but if it's a grave matter, it can be a mortal sin. And it is true that somebody could commit an act that is a grave matter and not be in a state of mortal sin.
Right.
Because of, like, say, a great example I always like to use, a terrible example, a young girl who is her parents forced her to basically get her to get an abortion.
Right.
Abortion's obviously a grave act.
Right, right. She's not, we can't hold her culpable for that.
Right. Her culpability, depending on how much she went along with whatever, is not necessarily at the level of a mortal sin
she may have even gone to a doctor. She may have, right. I remember there was a television series a million years ago about a priest and he supported abortion rights, you see. And so you may even go to your priest, or you may go to your pastor, or you may go to your doctor, your parents, your sister, and they all support you getting an abortion. And she's like, what is she? She's 16, right. Let's say. So, yeah, I mean, those are circumstances that mitigate. Right. So we're not going to hold her accountable for that.
And so
that doesn't mean it's not wrong.
Right. Of course. Yeah. And so theoretically, this young girl, in one of these situations, could in fact receive communion, and it would not be a sacrilegious act, because in fact she's not necessarily a mortal sin for all these various reasons. However, and so that's what I think Gabriel is trying to do. He's trying to say, okay, a comparable situation is a couple living in a, let's say they're divorced and remarried, civilly remarried, exactly. And so he's basically trying to argue that is a comparable situation, which they're not necessarily in a state of mortal sin because of these mitigating circumstances.
Right.
But it seems like, first of all, I think one of the big differences I see is one's a continuing action, whereas the other one is a one-time action, because it's not like the couple, maybe they did decide we're going to live brothers, whatever. And then they fall and they have relations and they come back and say, oh, now we'll go to confession for that.
Right, right.
We're not talking about that. We're saying they're just simply saying our relationship, which includes the physical dimension, we're fine with it. I mean, and we're just going to keep on being fine with it.
Right. He tries to provide a justification for the habitual penitent. So he has a section, of course, where he distinguishes. He says, it's not just that you're looking back on what you did, but you can apply these same criteria for future.
So would it be comparable to him? Like, for example, somebody who maybe has developed a habit of pornography.
I think, yes, because this is a more complicated discussion, because it also presumes that, that you can actually receive absolution. Under those circumstances, you see. But so it has sacramental significance if you think that you can be a habitual penitent for the same sin and continue to receive communion and so on. But before we, let's go to, so having talked a bit about this, the distinction between subjective and objective morality, the fact that mitigating circumstances, the person who's unable to, or says he's unable to recognize or accept this particular moral standard, as you said, I mean, comes to the office of the pastor, you got to get into a conversation of, is this person vincibly ignorant there? Did this person actually reason this out? Think, what are his reasons for this? You can't just because a person says, I'm unable to accept this, or I'm unable to recognize the validity of this moral norm, et cetera, in and of itself, that doesn't make it, that doesn't lessen the responsibility. I don't see that as a mitigating circumstance. That's why I say you have to actually then get into the reasoning that led this couple or this individual to that belief that contraception is fine, et cetera, et cetera. And of course, I don't see how it can be mitigating if he comes to a conclusion that's actually inconsistent with the moral truth about the conjugal life, the moral truth about marriage, all of that. It seems to me Gabriel does not spend time discussing, getting behind the reasoning and what informs that person's reasoning. Has this person been negligent in his reasoning? I said, is it just a case of rationalization here? There are all kinds of things that you then would have to discuss to see whether that person is really negligent, whether it's vincible. If it's vincible ignorance, that means that person is responsible for his ignorance.
Right.
There's, as I said, in Francis and even in Gabriel, there seems to be a certain optimism that somehow, you know, you're ready to hold individuals blameless without considering the reasons why they are unwilling to address the difficulty in accepting this.
Going back to our comparison with the girl, the young girl who gets the abortion, it'd be like going to her later after the abortion. A pastor goes up to her, explains to her the reality of what abortion is and all this. And then she just says, let's say she's, you know, it's a couple of years later and she says, oh, that I don't really accept the church's teaching that I'm going to keep on having abortions now. And acting like there's then no, that's, oh, that's, now we still have that mitigating circumstance. Well, no, now all of a sudden we're in a different situation.
We're in a different situation.
Right. And so the couple who met with their pastor and explained to them, and they just kind of basically say, well, we just don't accept that. Like you said, that's not a mitigating circumstance.
Right,
we've left mitigating circumstances now.
We're now in the realm of whether or not these people are responsible for the position that they take.
Right.
And you have to, how can you not, the Pope doesn't really attend to that. Let's put it that way.
Right.
Here's another thing. If we, Francis says, you got to read my whole book. Okay. I agree. And then he says, he's trying to fit himself into, there's a hermeneutic of continuity. You know, my position is consistent with the teaching of the church. And then thirdly, he says, my ethics is Thomistic.
Right.
Okay. Now, there are two reasons why his ethics is not Thomistic. And they both have to do with trying to find what seems to me to be exceptions, carving out an exception so that an individual can be justified in doing something that in fact is inconsistent with the demands of the demands of the objective moral law. Here's one thing. And remember that the Pope says that his reasoning can be applied to a variety of relationships.
Right.
Just to give you an example. I mean, I've never heard him say to Cardinal Supich, you're wrong here. Supich said in an article that when he was asked about communion, homosexuals, and he said, it's a lot easier, says Supich, to tell people what they are doing in black and white. The important thing in all of this is, as we move forward, is to recognize that people's lives are very complicated. There are mitigating circumstances, psychological, their own personal history, maybe even biological. It's not a matter of detracting from what the ideal is, he says. Homosexual couples may be led, he says, through a period of discernment to understand what God is calling them to at this point. At this point. And I say we have a situation ethics at work here. Because he's saying, basically, and I think that's the way to read paragraph 303 of Amoris Laetitia, despite what others have said, that the Pope is saying, it seems to me, that's the only way to read it. I don't understand people who read it differently, that he says, you can, with certainty, you can say that this is essentially the best that I can offer right now. The best that I can offer you. This is in paragraph 303. And so it seems to me, I don't see how it can be read in any other way. The Pope is saying that yes, it's mitigating circumstances. And under those circumstances, you're doing the best that you can. You're offering the most that you can offer, but you can have the certainty that what you're doing is, in fact, the will of God, even though what you're doing is inconsistent with the full demands of the objective moral law.
And why is that not Thomistic?
Well, in the first place, for two reasons. One reason is that the Pope does not distinguish between moral absolutes. The word moral absolute doesn't occur. Universal negative precepts, Thomas says, negative precepts are exceptionless moral norms. There can be no exceptions. They're valid always and everywhere. But Thomas distinguishes negative moral precepts from positive precepts that have presumptive validity, but for which under certain circumstances, they may not be applicable. And he gives an example of, update that you're going to a bachelor party with your friend and he gives you his keys. And of course, they're his keys. So you, by virtue of there being his keys, you're supposed to return them to him since they're his property. But it turns out at the end of the evening, he's drunk.
Right.
And you say to him, I'm not giving you these keys because you're drunk and I don't want you to get in an accident, kill yourself or kill somebody else. Okay. So you can carve out, let's say, an exception there where the presumptive validity of that moral principle, you know, this is my property, you have to give it back to me. The Pope does not make it. He ignores the distinction between moral absolutes. Thou shalt not commit adultery is a moral absolute.
Right.
It's an exceptionless moral norms. There are no. Thomas doesn't think that that thou shalt not commit adultery has presumptive moral validity, but that there are certain circumstances where it's not applicable. There have been people in the modern era, like I remember famously, situation ethics, people arguing for situation ethics, and we're trying to provide justification for this kind of stuff. So it seems to me Francis does not attend or even mention Aquinas' distinction between negative moral norms, which are moral absolutes that hold always and everywhere, and affirmative moral norms that have a presumptive validity, their prima facie obligations. He doesn't make that distinction. And so it's clear if you look at that, the section where he gets into a discussion about Thomas. This is
I remember when he starts talking about that, I was like, that does not work.
No, it doesn't work. And it's in paragraph 304.
Right, yeah.
Where he says, it is reductive simply to consider whether or not an individual action corresponds to a general law rule, because that is not enough to discern and ensure full fidelity to God in the concrete life of a human being. And then he goes on to cite Thomas, but he's citing Thomas. It would get a little bit too much in the weeds, as it were. But I think the simplest thing to understand is that he ignores Thomas's distinction between moral absolutes that are exceptionless moral norms and the presumptive validity of some moral norms. So you presume that they're valid.
Right.
Until you have circumstances where they're not applicable.
Right.
It's like, to give you an example, there are going to be circumstances under which it's morally permissible to allow a person to die. You know, that's different than positive euthanasia, which is doing something that results in the death of a person.
Right.
Or euthanasia where you fail to do something and that results in the death of a person. There are circumstances under which when you consider, is the treatment overly burdensome? What are the benefits, et cetera? The church has all kinds of criteria there.
Right.
And there's a difference between positive euthanasia in whatever form and allowing a person to die. The person has entered into the dying stage, as it were.
Right.
And so the church says it's morally permissible. Not morally obligatory. You're not obliged. You can still, if you think taking immunotherapy or whatever, if you think you want to do that because maybe it'll extend your life, I don't know, a couple of months, whatever. But the church says it's morally permissible for you to do X.
Right.
And that, you know, that's.
Yeah, and I think this is an important point because over and over in this chapter, he talks about a general rule. And the way it's talked about, it's kind of like, yeah, there's this general rule, but it's almost like every single general rule in the church
has an exception.
And has an exception.
Or is not necessarily applicable.
Right.
And the clearest that that's his intention is when he says it's reductive simply to consider whether or not individual actions correspond to a general law or rule. So he's trying to carve out a space there, it seems to me, where an individual is going to be justified in receiving communion, even if he's divorced and civilly remarried.
Right.
And what's the kind of reasoning that he uses there? It's what I call, what others have called, the lesser of two evils calculus. There's a lesser of two evils for him. Remember, he says, he quotes Gaudium et Spes, and he thinks that two people divorced, civilly remarried, they even have children. They can't, given the consequences of not having sexual relations in that marriage, that may ruin the relationship. I mean, et cetera, et cetera. And so he thinks that those two people can then continue to have sex because of the kind of impact it might have on the marriage and hence on the family if they have children. And so you have to then weigh the lesser of two evils here. And so that
just seems insane to me.
the morally permissible choice is made under a lesser of two evils calculus. Now, see, here too, it's not Thomistic.
Right.
John Paul II's position is Thomistic from Familiaris Contortio and paragraph 84 and so on. I say, in Aquinas's view, by contrast, this is a situation, the kind of situation I've just described, where this civilly divorced and civilly remarried people, they have children. And the question is, what if you stop having sex and what kind of consequences is that going to have for marriage? And what kind of consequences is that going to have for the children in the marriage? Will it lead to a breakdown of the marriage? And what are the implications of that for the children and so on? So you have to ask yourself, well, what is the lesser of two evils here? For Aquinas, this is a situation of perplexity for Aquinas. Indeed, a moral dilemma. And it's not a case of ignorance. And then I quote this Dominican theologian Bonino. He says, this is not a question of a factor that limits the voluntary or the subjective capacity to decide which we ordinarily understand as a mitigating circumstance, but of a situation that limits the objective choice and that forces the person to choose between two moral evils. See, that's what the Pope is asking us to choose. That's why it's the lesser of two evil calculus. The evil that seems to him to be the lesser. A person is placed in conditions such that it seems, no matter what he does or abstains from doing, that he cannot avoid sin. Now, on this point, St. Thomas seems rather to judge that there cannot exist such a true moral dilemma that would oblige a person to do an objective evil act, or, as the saying goes, to choose the lesser evil. Or rather, the dilemma exists, but it is caused by an earlier framework of sin that the person can and ought to renounce. So you got yourself into this situation. Well, Thomas says you have to renounce that earlier framework right. That got you into this situation. Thomas denies that this individual is perplexed or in a moral dilemma because he can lay aside his error, since his ignorance is vincible and voluntary. See, here again, we come back to that not all ignorance is a mitigating circumstance.
Right.
Not all ignorance is invincible. Not all ignorance is such that you're not responsible for it.
It also seems like, on the one hand, these supposed two evils, one is an objective evil and one is a speculative evil, because objectively, adultery is evil. Having relations with somebody not your spouse is evil. Right. However, this whole idea of like it might harm the kids, it might hurt a relationship, it might harm the kids. It's all speculative because we all know, I don't know, I mean, we don't all know, but a lot of us know people who have been in this situation and have heroically decided to live as brother and sister, to do whatever it takes to live the right way. And it's actually been a great blessing and graces have been bestowed.
Well,
upon
that was the, that was the, that was the pastoral guidance of John Paul II in paragraph 84 from the Familiaris Consortio. And Francis, the only thing that Francis accepts, I said this in an article I wrote way back in 2017 on Amoris Laetitia, the only thing that Francis actually refers to when he talks about Familiaris Consortio paragraph 84, is he likes the fact that the Pope says you have to, you know, consider the specific, you know, pastoral discernment of the situation and so on and so on. Right. But then he consciously, of course, he could have cited Familiaris Consortio 84. He could have cited the Pope's encyclical Reconciliation and Penance in paragraph 34, but he rejects. He could have cited Benedict's Sacramentum Caritas, paragraph 29. All of which say you have to live at brothers and sisters. Now, I know colleagues who say that the Pope there is actually endorsing, you know, that the most generous response is that you then live as brother and sister, as if that means that you're headed in the right direction. But I see no justification for that from paragraph 303. I say in this earlier article I wrote in 2017, it was published in Catholic World Report, Francis does not explicitly endorse what John Paul II is arguing for pastoral guidance. In fact, he avoids citing it, explicitly referring only to the statement that it is crucial to the logic of pastoral care to exercise careful discernment of situations. If Pope Francis meant what John Paul II meant, then why doesn't he say so? Right. Even in paragraph, because that's, you know, you have people who said paragraph 303 is really saying that the most generous response is to live as brother and sister. But there's absolutely no justification for that. Furthermore, he doesn't, because he denies the legitimacy, which the legitimacy of that position, because he says in footnote 329, in such situations where for serious reasons, such as the children's upbringing, a man and a woman cannot satisfy the obligation to separate, many people knowing and accepting the possibility of living as brothers and sisters, which the church offers them, point out that if certain expressions of intimacy are lacking, and then he wrongly quotes, but he quotes it anyway, Gaudium et Spes, paragraph 51, it often happens that faithfulness is endangered and the good of the children suffer. So here we're back again to this, this lesser of two evils calculus. And then I ask, is Francis suggesting here that under those circumstances, sexual intimacy is morally permissible, a subjectively good choice for the sake of maintaining a faithful, invalid marriage so that the children do not suffer? Now, all of the, a lot of the Pope's, you know, supporters, Father Spadaro and the former president of the Pontifical Council for the Interpretation of Legal Texts, Francesco Cogopamiri, the Archbishop, the Argentinian Archbishop Fernandez, who's the rector of the Catholic University there. I say if Pope Francis rejects their interpretation of AL 303 as a distortion and misreading of it, then why doesn't he say so?
Right.
He doesn't say so because he does not hold there to be a yes or no to the question in the logic of pastoral mercy. And if I may, just one last thing, and this is also a crucial point, the distinction that John Paul II drew between the law of gradualness and the gradualness of law.
Yeah, it's the last thing I wanted to make sure we brought up.
Everybody believes in the law of gradualness. Who doesn't believe in the law of gradualness? Why do we have confession? Everybody believes in the law of gradualness. Everybody, weakness. Remember I said Dante put, he didn't put weak people in hell, he put unrepentant people in hell. But the gradualness of the law is something entirely different. I don't think that Pedro Gabriel understands the gradualness of the law, because the gradualness of the law has to do with where moral precepts are situation and person specific, such that, you know, their situation and person specific moral norms, which provide a justification for you to do X, even if doing X is inconsistent, contradicts the objective demands of the moral law. I think the Pope, despite his disclaimer to the contrary, I think he inserts in his pastoral reasoning, he inserts the gradualness of the law, which again is inconsistent. It's inconsistent with Familiaris Consortio, paragraph 34. I say that because what's his name? Gabriel kept telling us that, you know, that Amoris Laetitia is consistent with, it's not consistent with Veritatis Splendor because it fails to recognize the distinction between moral absolutes. Moral absolute, that word never occurs in the Pope's mind.
Right.
In his language. To say that you have to, as he does at one point, that you have to, you know, have regard for the good of the moral law or the general rule doesn't tell me, what does that tell me?
Right.
So, now, this doesn't mean, you know, that Amoris Laetitia has nothing to say or nothing to teach us. Or, I mean, again, I think that the Pope's view of marriage is consistent. He affirms the permanency, the two-ness, even that male and female two-ness. I mean, he affirms that sexual differentiation is a fundamental prerequisite for the two to become one flesh. And he has a section there on the body and the moral and sacramental significance of the body. And all of that is fine, I say. No chapter 8, nobody would be.
Right, exactly.
I'm sorry, but no chapter 8, nobody would be discussing Moris Laetitia.
That's right. Okay, I think we're going to wrap it up here. I think we hit to the heart of the matter. Obviously, it's something we could do. You could do a college level course on.
Right, of course. We could talk about the sacraments and all.
Yeah,
that.
I want to encourage people though. Your book,
yes,
Pope Francis: The Legacy of Vatican II. I will put a link to it in the show notes.
Thank you.
It's from Lexio Publishing. And when was? I think this was not your. I think you had a multiple editions.
I had a first. This is the second edition.
Okay, second edition.
Here's the way. Just quickly, in the first edition, this sounds arrogant. I tried to save Francis by connecting him to John Paul and Benedict and all that. But by the time I got to working on the second edition, I thought it was unsavable.
Right, right. You just had to be honest.
Some of my colleagues would say, but no, to me, it was just not that there are good things. I mean, right. Where my most, not only the pastoral reasoning and all that, that's problem. His approach to interreligious dialogue is also right. Problematic in my view. Yes. And then even his understanding of ecumenism and the way he practices is also problematic.
Right. Absolutely. I agree with that. Yeah. Okay. Well, again, just encourage people, Pope Francis, The Legacy of Vatican II. And like I said, I'll put a link to it in the show notes. So thank you so much.
I appreciate that, Eric. I'm glad we had this time to talk about Pedro Gabriel.
Yes,
His book. I'm sure. I know he thinks it's. He's shown that chapter 8 is orthodox for all the reasons that we've talked about today. I don't think it is.
Right. Agreed. Okay. Well, thank you. I appreciate you being on the program today.
All right. My pleasure. Thanks a lot for the invitation. I appreciate it.
Okay. God bless you.
Take care.
Next time, everybody.
Okay.
God love you.